Testing, testing, testing.
Just about time before we go to the weather and a fun.
Everyone, and welcome to the farming program this week. But this week we've decided to take a look back in time at some of the things that made us what we are today, some of the things that shaped the industry that we all know so well today, and to hear at first hand what life was like just in the war years and immediately after the war years. I think I've come to talk to a lady who was involved in Manx agriculture really at the sharp end from a very early age, and I've come to Ballaghmurton in Onchan to talk to Laura Briggs. For Laura, you were a member of the Women's Land Army. How did you come to be a member of the Land Army?
Well, I was ready to leave school and I'd been applying for a job from school, which had been advised, and I'd finished my interview and was going to get on the bus to go home to Laxey, and on the way there I met Mr. Howie, who was then the agricultural organiser of the Isle of Man. And having known him since I was a small child, he asked me to see what I was doing at that time of the day, being away from school. And I said, well, I've been applying for a job, I'm ready to leave school now. And he said to me, you don't need to apply for a job, come and join the Land Army. That was in 1941, because the then Board of Agriculture had decided it was time to supplement the men who had gone from the farms, either being conscripted or had volunteered to join the forces. And we were being encouraged in the Isle of Man to grow as much food and produce as much meat as possible for all these people who were descending on us, because we had the airmen and people training the Navy camps, and we also had the internees and eventually some of the prisoners of war as well. And even though we had the men here before the war, they had all gone away, and we were getting dangerously short of staff.
How did a girl from a non-farming background know George Howie so well then, as to take him at his word and take his advice?
Well, actually, I had always spent my holidays down at the Barony farm, and the Barony was belonging to the workers at the time, and they had put in a manager, Mr. Roberts, and he and Mr. Howie were very, very friendly. And Mr. Howie used to go down there regularly. I used to spend my holidays down there because my uncle was the stockman at the time, and I lived out on the farm, and I used to go there. Every time there was a holiday, I used to say, can I please go on holiday? And off I'd toddle, pack my little bag and get on the Manx Electric Railway and get dropped off at the Glenmona stop. At the time, like everybody else joining up, I thought it was permanent. But on reading through some of our records later on, when we did a history of the Isle of Man, I found out that a lot of the girls who had joined also got out of it. It was too much for them, they just couldn't stand the pace.
So what was the first step then? You signed the form and you joined up. Where did you go then?
Well, Mr. Howie was very kind. He let me have my summer holidays, but just before September, I got word to say that I was to present myself at Knockalo on the September the 3rd, which was exactly 2 years after war started. And they had arranged accommodation near to the school, and I was to get to Knockalo for 6:45 on the Monday morning, which was September the 3rd.
So how you travelled from Laxey to Knockalo? How would you travel from Laxey to Knockalo in those days?
Ah, well, now there's a story in this too. My sister's boyfriend had been training in Canada. He was a fighter pilot later he was killed. And he'd come home on leave, and any serviceman doing that sort of thing was allowed a small amount of petrol. So on the Sunday afternoon, he kindly took me over to Knockalo, and at least to Patrick, and I settled in for the Monday morning.
So, and you had joined an army for all, you joined the Land Army. Were you issued with a uniform?
Oh no. My father was a carpenter, and by this time he was quite ill, but he still had some of his bib and brace overalls. Now, I was the smallest of our family, not very tall, and he was a tall man. He must have been nearly 6 foot. He was slim, I'll say that. But I must have looked peculiar. My mother took them in and also took the legs up quite a lot. So I arrived there and I had at least one pair of bib and brace overalls. There was nothing very much else. But, and to say that I joined the Manx Women's Land Army, I was recruit number 5, and it was a very slow process. The girls just weren't joining.
Mm.
I mean, there weren't many girls who fancied that sort of life.
And did you receive any training then?
Well, I was over at Knockalo for 6 weeks, but quite honestly, I don't really know. They hadn't sort of... they hadn't got any particular program. I can remember we did strange jobs like thrashing cocksfoot.
Mm.
And in the afternoons when I got there, I was the only one at the time, until another lamb girl came later. But I was lucky enough to be able to milk. And the arrangement was that we went down to Mr. Pete Kelly's farm just across the road from Knockalo, and we were to learn to milk, the hand milk for cows.
That was anyway, at Shinvala, of course.
At Shinvala across the road.
Mm.
Anyway, I was lucky, and I loved hand milking. It was lovely going down there, and then there was a nice tea afterwards. That was part of it. Lovely homemade bread and jam, homemade jam. And, of course, that was the usual lunch, as we call it, the afternoon lunch. But... while I was there, of course, some of the internees were there. We were told, we were warned off not to have any communication with them or anything. Well, I was on my own. It didn't matter to me because I was just milking. But what a sorry look, sorry lot they looked over there. I think they were taking up potatoes at that particular time, and they were so bedraggled. And of course they had guards with them. Some of them were Moseley's men, some of them were Italians, people who had been taken from their homes and just put to peel.
Were they resentful then? Did they resent being sort of interned here at Knockalo?
Well, while I was there, one night I went into the pictures in Peel, and halfway through the film there was a message put on the screen, would all military personnel report to headquarters. We didn't know what the matter was, but when we got out of the cinema, we could hear it. They rioted, and it is recorded now when they did riot. It must have been sometime at the end of September or beginning of October, and it was a horrifying sound. It was dreadful. I was glad to get back to Patrick.
Mm. So after your initial training period then, you were ready for work on the Manx farms. Did you go then?
Well, I must mention that while we were over there, Miss Annie Neen was, of course, in charge of the poultry. And on the special days, I think it was Friday we did them, we were taught to wring a hen's neck, pluck them, and she taught us everything that we needed to know in dressing poultry.
Right.
She was marvellous.
Mm.
I will say, it wasn't a very enjoyable job because, of course, we got the itches, the fleas. But, I have that to thank Annie for, because up to a few years ago, I could still pull a hen's neck, get rid of a cockerel or two. But, was one of the things. And
they were the real things of life, weren't they?
Yes. Mm. We had to get used to it and yeah. be practical.
Yes.
But as I say, I don't think they had a program mapped out for us, because it was only a very young sort of business, really.
Mm.
And when we went there, I did quite a lot with Mr. Bobby Gale. He used to take me round his beloved sheep up in the Craig and up on the top. I think I might have got my love of sheep from him, really, because oh, he was so proud of them, and it was lovely to walk along the top. And I mean, it was all work. We couldn't drive there on tractors then, but it was all work. But it was nice, and the people were so nice. I mean, they would help. One of the lads there, working at Knock Halo, lent me his bike to go up and down from a lunchtime, because Knock Halo Road is very long, and to have only an hour for lunch to get up and down, I'd have needed to jog, I think. But anyway, Eddie McCreesty, and then of course my aunt and uncle were farming over at Dorby, and he lent me his bike so that I could go over and see them at night.
Well,
and of course, we were always hungry in those days. You could eat like a horse. People go over and get a good feed over there, and then come back at night.
Right. Well, it's interesting to hear you mention Bobby Gale. Bobby Gale, again, is another respected man in Manx agriculture. Dedicated stockman, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. He was so proud of his stock. And he was so nice. And I will admit, he was very, very nice to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was working with him quite a lot, and we were digging out one of the foundations for one of the piggeries there, just the two of us. We were there and talking about all sorts of things and getting on, because when you're doing a job like that, you can always talk. It's not boring.
That's right.
I know it's hard work, but it's not boring.
Yeah. So you moved on from Knock Halo to your first Manx farm. Where was that?
Down at the Lough. It seemed to be the other side of the moon, because in those days, not very many people had cars. And I know we used to go around on the summer school picnics and things, but we never touched places like down at the Cronk and down at Balaf, nearly on the borders of Derby. But Mr. Neem and Mr. Howie took me down to see the farm on Thursday. I think it would be of the 6 week I was there. And he left me there to get to know the owner and to get to know Mrs. Neem, and then I had to travel back on the train, which was a great thrill. I was given a voucher to travel on the train, and then get off at St. John's and walk through to Patrick.
Right.
Mm.
And that would be 2.5-3 miles?
Oh, yes. That was when I got... I must have got back about 7 o'clock or so.
Right. And eventually you were posted there to Ballymona?
Well, they had already arranged that I was going there. I mean, it was a fait accompli.
Mm.
And the next morning they said you can have a long weekend, which was from Friday, and then I had to present myself down at Ballymona on the Monday.
I mean, if you've heard the first part of the programme, you'll realise that I'm talking to Laura Briggs, recounting those halcyon days. Were there halcyon days, Laura, in the Women's Land Derby? Or were they anything but?
I wouldn't call it halcyon. It was hard work. I've never worked so hard in my life. When I went to Ballymona, there was only the boss, as we called him, Mr. Dean, and Louis Corkle, the horseman, and myself. And I was told that we would get on all right if everybody worked together, and there was a lot of work to do, because of course there was a lot of the land that had to be broken up by order of the government.
So time has passed, but how old were you when you actually went on to Ballymona to work?
Just 17.
And so was there some consideration for a girl of 17 coming on to do farm work from a non-farming background, or were you just given the jobs to do?
Just given the jobs to do. We started at 5:45 in the morning and went out to the cow shed. And of course, at that time, Mr. Neem was one of the noted breeders of shorthorns. He had a wonderful herd, and there were 16 of them there. By the time I left in 1945, we'd upped the number to 23. And by that time, I was ordered to take care of the milking and the yard work while the men were in the fields. When I went there, I didn't tell you how much money we got.
Oh, no, that would be...
At Knockalo, when we went to Knockalo, we were allowed 30 shillings a week, but 25 shillings of that was taken for lodgings. So 5 shillings didn't go very far.
And how many hours a week would that be for?
Well, at Knockalo it was different, but when we got down on the farm, we were given 18 shillings a week, and 22 shillings was allowed for our keep. So, of course, our keep was regarded as more expensive than the work that we were putting in.
And what sort of work were you putting in?
The ruling was that we were to do 109 hours in a fortnight. But as everybody knows, if there's a job wanting doing on a farm and the weather looks as if it's going to change, you work until dark, or you work until the job is finished.
And did you?
Oh, yes. Always. It didn't matter. I mean, it was our duty to do it. And I mean, if the men were working, you naturally enough thought, well, get on with it. When I went down there, of course, we all, shall I say, mucked in. We milked in the morning, and Louis looked after his horses, if you could call them horses. Mr. Neen had a tractor by this time, and he was adapting the horse equipment to fit the tractor. It was a Fordson, and as you know, there were no hydraulics on that, so they were all dragging implements. And Louis had to make do. He was a wonderful ploughman. He was wonderful with the horses, like every other good horseman. He took a great pride in his work, and he had one massive shire by the name of Barney, and he didn't like to back, so you had to watch out every time you had him in the cart and was backing him, because his feet went everywhere. And the other little one that he had to go with Barney was what we would call a float pony. It was only a half-legged horse. And
just in passing then, did Barney ever stand on your foot?
Oh, too true. Backing in loads of turnips. Oh, dear. From what I remember, I don't think they were shod, so it wasn't quite so bad. We were on level ground down there, and but little Kate, I mean, she was only a small little thing. When I was using Barney, I had to climb up on the side of the stalls in the stable to get his collar on and to get the saddle on him, the cart saddle. He was massive, he really was. And then I don't know how Louis did his ploughing and things like that, because, I mean, one massive one yes. Very small one.
And Louis himself was only short of stature, wasn't he?
He was, and starting to be crippled then.
Yes.
His back was going over. But, he was very proud of his work and took a great... He really did. To see his work was wonderful.
Right.
He always used to tell me about when he was in Bishop's Court. There's one field in particular on Bishop's Court that's up and down and hollowed, and he used to say that my ploughing was always straight.
Right.
I think he was actually a champion ploughman, I'm not sure. And he did take a great pride in all that he did.
Yeah.
He was wonderful to work with, and in a way I owe my life to Louis, because he saved me when a bull turned on me, a bull that I'd reared. And I'd taken him out for water, because of course we'd no mains water in those days, we'd no electricity, and had taken him out to the horse trough for a drink while Louis cleaned out his pen. And on the way back he just whipped me around, because of course his weight was much greater than mine. I was about 8 stone at the time, and he just got me up against the wall, and Louis heard what had happened and managed, he had the grip in his hand, and we managed to get the bull in. But
there'd be no dehorning in those days. There'd be a bull with horns.
And of course he was pedigree. He was one of the wild eyes breed, which was a very notable breed, but
indeed.
He was not only wild eyes, he had a wild temper as well. But I don't know why he changed, because I had reared him. And, but
that's the nature of bulls though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mm.
I never trusted another one. I don't like bulls at all. Yeah. In fact, I said if Harvey ever got one, it was a cause for divorce. Fell off the mark.
But Laura, you've come a long way in your time at Ballymona. But how did you actually live at Ballymona? Did you have lodgings, or did you?
Yes, we lived. I lived in a family. quite a number of the girls, as they lived near, all the girls who were in the Land Army didn't go through Knockalo. Some of them went straight on to farms. And even though we've got lists of the girls that went through Knockalo, that isn't the true list, because quite a number of them went straight onto the farms. And if they lived close at home, of course, they could live at home and travel. But for anybody, and it was down the north, really, that there was the shortage of work, because, of course, the north is very productive, and there weren't the number of people. I know everybody helped each other, and in the harvest and the hay, everybody helped, but there still wasn't enough help around. And there were times when the rations were desperate. We didn't realise until we were doing the history of the Land Army, and we were going through the records at the museum, we didn't know that 1 week there was a shortage of beef over here, and they had to import it. We didn't have enough beef to supply the ration that was needed for all the inhabitants. We didn't get to know this sort of thing then. I mean, you hadn't time really to read the papers or anything else. And it was amazing how much was expected for the production. You just had to get on with it. And I know when I went down there, I could at least milk, but most of the other jobs, docking, carting turnips, carting kale, cutting it, bringing it in no matter what weather, you had to go out in any weather. And of course there weren't the Macintosh, you hadn't got rubber gloves or anything else. And we did get uniforms in 1942, and we also got a supervisor, Miss Betty Teer, and she had experience. She'd gone across to see how they were running the Land Army across, and she came round regularly to see everything was all right and to bring our new uniforms and things like that. But the Board of Agriculture at the time and Tynwald were complaining about the cost of the Land Army.
At 18 shillings a week?
Well, it was actually the farmer who paid those, but the government must have been getting the uniforms from across. They must have had some sort of arrangement with the British government, because I know when I left, I had to hand back. Miss Tia came to collect all the uniforms that I had, and that was in 1945. We didn't get any, what every other...
Were you demobsuit or civvies?
Oh yes, we got, that is one thing that we did get, we got 10 extra coupons, because we were allowed extra coupons with doing heavy work. Over and above our ration of clothing coupons, we were allowed 10 extras, but we didn't get any money like the rest of the...
No gratuity.
That's the word. No gratuity at all. We got 10 extra coupons when we came out. I don't know how they expected us to live on the money that we were getting, but having talked to lots of English Land Army girls since, because there's a lot of them living here in the Isle of Man, they've all said the same. It was really, for those living away from their home, it was really a struggle to live on the money that we got. I'd raised my money in the 4 years that I was in the Land Army. I'd raised it from 18 shillings to 32 and six.
Laura, we've come almost to the end of this tape, but I'm sure you've got an awful lot more to tell us, and this is going to stand easily another programme. You've so much to share with us, and I know that you've shown me photographs. You're parading for the Queen Mother, example, the Queen at the time, and you've much more to tell us about that. Can I come back again and do another tape with you about your experiences in the Land Army?
Yeah, this is the trouble. You start talking, we don't know when to stop.
Laura Briggs. Laura Briggs, thank you very, very much for talking to us, and I can tell you this is being recorded in Ballacomerton, an old, comfortable farmhouse, and we're here in front of a roaring fire. We could talk for hours, and I'm sure after this tape is switched off, we will do. But Laura, for the time being, and until we do some more recording, thank you very much indeed. This is John Kenyuk signing off for now. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Farming Programme. I'm John Kenyick, and each week at this time we bring you interesting topics from the Manx countryside, but from farming in particular. The weather this week, it always seems to be a topic with which to start this programme, but that's the factor that governs most farming activities. And this week we've seen a return to the very, very cold snap that we've been experiencing, and it's provided all sorts of problems for those who are turning cows out. Some have been turned out for a few days now, have been brought back in again, fields are starting to cut up. Young lambs just put out of a lambing shed, for example, are feeling the effects of these wintry showers. We had the same time last year, and it wreaked havoc then. But we hope it will be short-lived, and perhaps by the time this is broadcast, it will have blown over. But this week, my guest is a man who has contributed to this programme many, many times before. He has a wealth of knowledge about farming history in the Isle of Man and the history of farming organisations. And on an evening quite recently, we joined together in the NFU office to amalgamate the Western branch of the Manx National Farmers Union and the Eastern branch. And I thought that for this week's programme, I would talk to Harvey Briggs, because he was actually a founder member of the Eastern branch when it was founded a good number of years ago now.
Well, looking around, I can't see anybody who was at the inaugural meeting. There probably might be somebody who will come on after this program and say I was there, but I was certainly there, and it was a traumatic experience for me because, believe it or not, I was evicted from it. Yes.
Does that mean you were worse then than you are now?
Yes, well, the long and short of it was the meeting was called for a Saturday afternoon in St. Matthew's Hall, and Deemster Ramsay Johnson, he was the founder of the union, and he thought that the best way to get in touch with everybody, or to get the best people necessary to start the union, was to call together all those who had been on the parish ward agricultural committees.
Well, what was that now? What was the parish agricultural committee?
Yes, well, they were appointed by the government at the outbreak of war by 1940, anyhow, they'd been appointed, and they comprised about 10 or a dozen of the best farmers in each parish. And they met regularly on a monthly basis, and their job was to see that every farm produced to capacity. For instance, 30% of every farm had to be in grain. And for 2 years, I think it was 1942 to 43, they had to grow 10% of that 30% had to be in wheat.
Really?
For bread, because rationing was severe and food was scarce, and they thought that they could get a lot more food from Manx land.
Was this peculiar to the Isle of Man, Harvey, or was it true in the UK as well? Did they have similar organisations in the UK as well?
Oh yes, it was nationwide.
Right.
And it was based on this, on the UK form, that the Isle of Man had its own parish ward agricultural committees. Mm. And they did a lot of good, because apart from them overseeing the every farmer in the parish. A farmer here, my uncle James McCubbin, he had about six farms in the district he had to keep an eye on. Didn't always make him too popular, but people did realise that there was a war on, and that conditions were such that we had to have the food off every available acre.
What was the resistance then to the policy that this committee might have adopted?
Well, a certain amount, but yes, there was always some, of course, always will be. Mm. But the war ags, they call them, the parish war ags, they did another good job in that they raised a lot of money for charity, because I think those of us on the farms were conscious of the fact that we didn't have to go and fight, so consequently we tried to do what we could. We raised money for Red Cross, for King George Fund for Sailors, and all sorts of things, and that was part of their work. But anyhow, getting back to, by 1946, of course, October 1946, the war was well over. The War Ag committees had been disbanded, the names were still there in some government form, in some government office. So Ramsay Johnson, he sent a notice round to all the former War Ag members. That would make about 10 and up to 17 parishes. There might have been 180 or to 200 notices sent out. And they came in and quite a flock to St. Matthew's Hall on this afternoon. Anyhow, when I, my uncle, James McCubbin, he wasn't too keen on the political side of farming, and I was just emerging as having some interest in it, and I was going to town on a Saturday afternoon. I didn't get every Saturday afternoon. It was only occasional. But anyhow, I was going this day, and he said, here, he said, would you like to have a look in this meeting, see what's happening? So he gave me the card, because you were supposed to show the card at the door to indicate who you were, to prove who you were, you see.
In the Isle of Man, huh?
Oh, in the Isle of Man. So
you still got your car?
No, unfortunately. Yes, anyhow, I handed it in at the door, and I'm not sure who was there. I think it was somebody from Athol Street that Ramsay Johnson got there to steward the job, and I handed it in, and this chap looked at me, and obviously I was only a lad there, not much more than a lad, and he looked at me and said, you're not this Jim McCubbin, are you? And I said, well, no, I'm not. Well, you can't come in here, then. So, anyhow, I went rather crestfallen, and I was walking along North Quay, and I met Billy Moore of Bigode. Billy was a great supporter of this idea, and he said to me, hey, boy, aren't you going into the meeting? Well, I said, I intended going, but long and short it was, I said, they won't let me in. What? They won't let me in. Oh, come with me, he said. If they're going to turn young people away from the union, he said, there's little hope of it ever succeeding. So he took me in, explained the situation, and I went in. So I was present at the very first meeting.
Oh, wow. And Ramsay Johnson was a formidable figure, wasn't he, and a very prominent figure in agricultural circles.
He was. He'd done a lot for the Agricultural Marketing Society. He was in practically every organisation that was going. He founded the union, and of course the great thing was that he went round every one of the 17 parishes in the winter of 1946 to 47, and by January of 1947 we were into the worst winter in living memory. Snow drifts, frost, you name it, we had the whole lot. I'll never forget it. Do you remember it, John?
I just barely remember it. I remember the effects of it.
Yes.
And this man travelled all over the world.
With Paul Gelling, who was the first secretary. Paul's not long dead. He made a great contribution. And one or two other farmers would sometimes go with him. I know that Eddie Cool from Bebelo, across the road here, a neighbour of mine, he would support them. And the farmers took in turns going, but he was stuck in places like Derby, and I don't know whether he got home some nights.
Was he a very persuasive man then, Harvey?
Yes, very. He was, although he was, he wasn't a great orator as such. I never thought he was a great orator, but what he said, everybody hung onto every word when he made speeches at dinners. Nice. And the great thing for me is a budding journalist in those days was that when he was making a speech at a dinner, he always gave you a copy of it beforehand.
Right.
And he kept to it. He never deviated. And you could go home and you could write stuff and know that you had it exactly right. But anyhow,
what was his response at the parishes then, when he went out to the parishes with this idea of forming a Manx National Farmers Union?
Well, I think it was very good, because the World Agricultural Committees, although with a few people, they weren't very good favour, but for the most people found that they did get everybody together.
And what basis did he sort of sell the idea on then? What was his selling point when as he tried to persuade these men to sort of follow him and form the union?
Well, for long enough, one of the slogans of the union was English prices and English conditions.
Right.
Yes, because they thought that in the Isle of Man we were a long way behind
English
conditions. Well, I think we were, probably. Yeah. But on the other hand, as you know, John, there's extenuating circumstances in the Isle of Man doesn't always apply. I mean, one thing was that they wanted a better price for milk in the winter, you see. Well, of course, the demand in those days for the tourist trade was for milk in the summer.
Mm.
So pricing milk on the English basis didn't really work in the Isle of Man, but it was things like that that I suppose farmers thought that they were behind, so they did come in behind the banner of the union, and there was a tremendous support of it. We had a parish branch formed in Onchan, and for many years I think it was probably one of the strongest branches. But the times have changed. But we used to meet, and one thing I remember in the first days of the union, I used to walk over the fields, over footpaths, to get to Hillbury, where we held our meetings. Yes, I mean, you wouldn't think of doing it today. You wouldn't get anybody to do it today.
No.
If you were lucky, some of the more prosperous farmers might have a car and you might get a lift home.
And was that regarded then as a sort of a central point for the people who would be attending the meeting at Hillbury?
Yes, Hillbury was the basis. We did on occasions go into Onchan because it had bigger halls and more comfortable halls, actually. but we did go into Onchan, especially if it was expected that there were going to be more people. And on occasions we had 80 to 100 to a meeting.
Really?
Yes, because especially it wouldn't all be farmers or farm members, because especially around the election time with the candidates for Middle, we were in Middle there, covered the parishes of Onchan, Santon and Braddon, as well as the village of Onchan. Well, Onchan wasn't so big, it hadn't got so many people living in it, so the country vote was very important to candidates.
Yes.
It could swing an election.
So the NFU meetings then were seen as a vehicle for expression of opinion and not necessarily just farming then?
No, they had a wider offer. In Onchan especially, they seemed to have a wider appeal.
And was there a social side to it as well? I mean, there wouldn't be all that many events in the countryside. It was a chance to meet people.
We've had our dinners, yes, we had dinners, and we had a concert, I remember, in what used to be the Avenue Cinema in Onchan, where the governor and his lady there. Oh, yes, we used to put in quite a lot of social life. And, of course, the pity of it is that I was for some time secretary of the Onchan branch, and I think I sent out about 46 notices, although it was only a small parish room. It's scattered because it goes right up to Windy Corner.
Yes,
but
indeed.
A lot of sheep up there, but not many farmers. But anyhow, I used to send out about 46 notices. And now, looking around the other day, I suppose there's about 10 practicing farmers in the parish.
Yeah. Can you remember some of the issues that sort of occupied your time at these meetings in those early days, Harvey? You talked about English prices. Anything else that you can remember that were the burning issues of the day?
Oh, well, of course, the great thing in 1956 was the fat stock scheme, because what had happened up till then was that all fat stock had to go to the marts, and it was allocated by a farmer and a butcher to somebody else, and they graded it. It was allocated to the butcher, rather, and they graded it, and it was on the on live grading, and it was on that you were paid. Well, obviously, it was a system that was a relic from the wartime, but by 1955 or the early 50s, meat rationing, I think, went on till 1954. But after that, they became first of a surplus of cattle and sheep, and the thing was that a market had to be found for them. The government was getting a bit tired of financing this system, having to pay for graders, and so Ramsay Johnson's idea was that we should have a scheme whereby the government or one of his agents, or his agent, still bought all the cattle and sheep and put them through the two central two abattoirs at that time. All the country abattoirs had been wiped out through the regulations after the war, but there was still an abattoir at Ramsay, and another one, the main one, was in Lake Road in Douglas.
Yes.
So the Johnson scheme, was known as the basis of the present fat stock scheme. It was formulated in 1946, but of course there were a lot of farmers, a lot of opposition to it, in as much as that some farmers wanted to go back to the cut and thrust of live auctions.
Yes.
Ramsay Johnson said, that's all very well, but if you're going to do that, you're going back to the butcher's rings. Mm. With all due respect, I've got none of butcher friends, but they did operate rings. They just sat round in the, they were the only ones that sat inside the rings at the auction mart, so they had their form there, and when they'd satisfied, they just walked out and went home. And if you were late coming with your stock, it was too late. You had no market, you had to take them home.
Do you think it took somebody like a Deemster then, who was used to sort of even-handed judgment, to sort of see this situation and to work out something that addressed both sides equally?
You could be right there, yes. And of course, yes, he had, and he had the legal training, and he drew up the scheme, and I don't know whether you've ever seen it, John, but it's I've got to have a copy. Mm. It's fantastic in as much as there were no loopholes.
Right, right.
Whereas a group of farmers trying to do it probably got into no end of legal trouble. So.
And here we are nearly 50 years later, still using the same scheme, and still applauding the man who brought it into being. With all the changes that have taken place, that's quite remarkable, Harvey.
Yes, virtually the same scheme. Mm. Yes, this is based on that, and been some changes, but certainly I think it has been one of the salvations of Manx agriculture, and could we still have retained that with the Agricultural Marketing Act, as they were laid down in 1934 and improved on but a few years after that, I'm sure that Manx agriculture would be far more competitive today than it is.
What about the personalities, Harvey, that you remember in the union in those early days? You talked of Willie Moore Bagode and Ramsay Johnson and Henry Cool at Babelo.
Yes.
Eddie Cool, wasn't it? Eddie Cool at Babelo.
Henry Edward, but Eddie was known as.
Yes. Who else? Do you remember anybody else that was prominent in union matters?
Well, the first chairman of the Honken branch was R.G. Shimon from Lower Sulby.
Mm.
And he was a man who'd worked with farmers he was a farmer himself, but had one. He operated three thrashing mills in the days of steam engines. He went out of them in 1941. He was a very clever man. He saw that the combine harvesters were coming in. Although the first combine harvester didn't come to the Isle of Man until 1944, he knew that these.
Yes.
And he was in the position where he would have to replace all this steam threshing equipment, his mills and his balers. Right. So what did he do? He decided to sell them off. He was engaged in other things because he was chairman of the Isle of Man Dairies, and Isle of Man Dairies was the forerunner. Well, the Milk Marketing Association was going in those days, but it didn't have any commercial undertakings at all. It eventually, in 1961, it took over the Isle of Man Dairies, but at that time the Isle of Man Dairies must have had about 80 suppliers from roundabout, and it was the main means of farmers selling milk. Because instead of going round having to deliver it from door to door, they had this, the milk was taken every, no matter how much they produced, it was taken every day.
Yes.
And what was not required for the rounds, they made into cheese. Mm. And they were the forerunners of the Manx cheese industry.
Yes, yes. And, go on.
Oh, sorry, yes. And of course there were others, Clifford Knifton. He was a great supporter, predecessor of yours as president.
Mm.
I mean, if I was to ask to name some of the great presidents, Clifford Knifton would be one.
Right.
John Kenyon could be another.
But those men in their day were great men, though, weren't they? And they were leaders of the industry in those days.
Oh, yes, yes. You know,
Clifford Knifton.
Yes, that's right. And another man.
And yet he didn't have a farming background, Clifford Knifton.
Oh, well, he did, really, because his father, his father came to farm at Babelo Bay, across the road from here, where we're talking now. His father came, and he had two sons, Clifford Knifton and Norman Knifton. Well, Norman was really the farmer. Clifford was more the businessman.
Right. Maybe that's the side that I've got to hold off. Yes.
But unfortunately, Norman died in 1935.
Mm.
He left three young sons who've gone on, of course, Gordon Knifton, Raymond Knifton, Peter Knifton, all made their mark in other spheres.
Yes, indeed.
But too young then to farm. And eventually Tom Knifton, the father, did keep it up. Cliff had knifed and went on to run his lime quarries and Turkey Land, and he also went into the House of Keys as a member for Middle.
Yes.
As I told him once, we never forgave him because we all worked to get him in, and after about 2 years he found that he couldn't do his job in the Keys and run a business as well, and he retired from and resigned from the in mid-term.
Did he really?
And we had to start all over again.
Oh, well,
that's when we got another man, Edward Brownsden, in. Now, Edward Brownsden was another great supporter of the Farmers' Union.
Right.
And he was another, in fact, the members for Middle here, a lot of them have made a great contribution to agriculture.
Yeah.
There was George Drummond, Harry Cowan, he was a member, and Harry was an excellent chairman of the Board of Agriculture.
That's
right. Was in those days, very approachable, and he did a lot of good work. And, you know, we had a by-election in Onchan last year, four candidates, and only one of them mentioned agriculture.
Right. Right.
It just shows you that at that time, in the days that I'm talking about, the farmers could put
their man in.
Put a man in, but it's got to the stage where candidates never even mentioned them.
Yes, yes. Harvey, it didn't stay at branch sort of level all through, did it? It changed from parish level, rather.
Yes.
It changed to a different formation now.
Yes, in 1972, they decided that, travel had become easier for one thing. I mean, we didn't have to walk over the footpath to the meetings. Most of us by that time had a car or van of some sort, not always dependable.